The topic for this session of the Futures Forum is of particular interest to all school teachers. All teachers know that they are preparing their students for a world which does not yet exist, and hence helping them prepare for the future is of particular importance. Our guest has a lot of experience helping teachers and students do just that. Deb Bateman is currently the Deputy Dean of Global, Urban and Social Studies at RMIT University, a role she recently took up after 7 years at Deakin. Deb began her working life as a primary school teacher after deciding that becoming a hairdresser wouldn't work for her, but it's through her work as a teacher educator that her interest in future studies has been most expressed. Deb's research covers three main areas. The first of these is her passion for futures thinking and its application for curriculum, as well as capacity building future generations through education. Second research area is in curriculum policy and disruptive pedagogies through contextual innovations, and she also has a great interest in the use of emerging educational technologies, which is one of the reasons why we're starting a little late today, getting the technology connected. Her topic today is teaching futures, and I know she has a lot to tell us. Welcome, Deb.
Thank you. I'll talk loud so I'm there, and I'm going to keep swinging around because technologies can be difficult depending on which platform I think you operate on. So I'm going to take you through a bit of a journey in terms of how I think about futures in education. I'm not going to talk about the future of education because I think that often there's a lot of confusion between thinking about futures in education and its applications. My other kind of disclaimer is when I think about teaching futures in education, I'm thinking about how we can use the interdisciplinary area of future studies, how we can use the tools and concepts and be quite explicit in how we teach, you know, from the youngest ages and make connections between what happens in classrooms and, you know, how children might be able to contribute actively to shaping their futures. And when I say children, you know, it's interesting when you look at young children use futures thinking and then as we get older. And so I'm going to kind of do a bit of a journey on that way, all right? Feel free to stop me as we go. So I think I could play the song for you, but you will know it, you know. And for me, this type of song represents some of the contradictions of our society in thinking about, we know that children are our future generations. We make a lot of assumptions about the role that education plays in educating for different futures. But as societies, particularly in the Western world, we're not very good at articulating what type of future that is. And often what we do is we make it very singular and we're not creative about, you know, teasing out all of the possibilities. So I guess my research has really tried to look at how classroom practice can really take an active role in that and how teachers need to actually invest in their own futures, you know, thinking and temporality in order to bring that to the fore. When I began, I'll come to where I began in a moment. Part of my journey as a primary school teacher was that I worked in a range of schools. And I worked in schools that varied in terms of their socioeconomic status and their academic orientation. And there was a particular point in my career as a teacher that I began to think about the young children in my classroom and some of the taken-for-granted futures that they had. A lot of them, by the age of 8, were thinking about the roles they were going to take, you know, in their parents' place on a production line, for example. They assumed that the ways that they were going to grow up would be exactly the same, replicating. So we talk about those as used futures. And so there was also a time, it was also at a time where a lot of curriculum change was going on in Australia. And we were moving from a very state-based curriculum, which was called the Frameworks, into the first attempt at a national curriculum, if you like, or a version of it, which was the Profiles, this attempt that we were going to have these kind of documents that went through. And then one of the things that came out of that was this idea that there were key areas of learning, you know, the key learning areas, KLAs, because everything has an acronym in education. And that was really the start of how we started to think about broadening the traditional kind of areas of curriculum, but, you know, teasing them out a little bit more, but organising the ways that we could educate through those things. And for me, a lot of those documents were really problematic because they kept talking about educating for a future, but they didn't actually articulate what that was about or why we had the KLAs and how that kind of connected to different students' futures. So I wrote to the then Education Minister and said, look, you know, this is really cool, but the CSF, the Curriculum Standards Framework, it actually makes all of these statements about, you know, educating our students for the future. What future is it that you think you're kind of educating for? And he wrote me this very, very lengthy response that you won't be able to read, but the bit, I guess, that I'd like to read explicitly to you says, in your letter, you refer to schools preparing students for the future. This should not be confused with futures education. In the instance you cite, this refers instead to the notion that all student learning provides them with knowledge, skills and understandings which they will be able to use in work, home and leisure activities in the future. That was really interesting for me, and then became kind of the journey that I went through in my Masters of Education and then my PhD. Because the discourse of futures is so assumed, and if you look at some of the people who have written in this area, this idea of tacit token or taken for granted, that was Noel Goff's kind of idea. And then over the years of my research, I've thought more about how we, the notion of implicit futures and explicit futures. And I think the implicit futures is this idea that we're doing it and it's connected to what kids are going to need to know, but we're not necessarily connecting it to that explicit kind of area. In Australia, we've had a number of moves in terms of curriculum. I think the next slide is curriculum. I've recently been working with the Taiwanese government to do a lot of their futures infusion through their curriculum. And it's really interesting because I would consider that they have the most kind of siloed curriculum areas and the most traditional kind of orientations to Western curriculum. And yet they are desperate to infuse futures curriculum because they think that that's the bit that's missing. And part of their motivation has been because a lot of Taiwan is built on fault lines. And so one of the things that they've dealt with in classrooms is this very sophisticated alarm system, which is glasses of water around the room. And as an earthquake or something is about to occur, everybody watches for the water. And as soon as the water starts moving, then the schools are evacuated. And then, of course, there's been, you know, a lot of lives lost. There's been a lot of damage to property. There's been all of those things. And so they've realised that perhaps the way that they've taken for granted, you know, life and culture and all of those things, and they're also starting to look to the difference between what they do in education and what some of the Eastern countries do or the Scandinavian countries do that make the difference. And they're desperate to be number one on that PISA ranking table. So they've climbed fairly rapidly, you know, and they've identified that the bit of their curriculum that's missing, and Dave Hicks wrote about this a lot, was the futures curriculum, the explicit futures curriculum. So that's what they've been doing. In Australia, we've had a lot of moves. At the moment, everybody knows that we're under the Australian curriculum, this idea of national curriculum, that in the same way that, you know, 15 years ago or 20 years ago, we had this same move. You know, there was the introduction of the profiles, but every state then reverted to kind of its version because we have to customise curriculum. So curriculum is generally the vehicle that a society transmits its culture. It privileges particular knowledge forms. And one of the things that it does, often if you think about the time of the Enlightenment, when schools really formally began, is it tries to use history, for example, as a way of inducting its students into the things that it values most. And one of the challenges that history generally fails is that it fails to make the explicit connection. So Richard Slaughter, when he started writing in the futures area, he started talking about futures studies and futures thinking as a forward-looking history. So in some of the other practical publications I've made, so I think about research is really important and very deep and theoretical, and then these practical applications where you write for teachers and schools and you work with schools. So in some of those, I've actually written in history text from a futures perspective to help teachers to be able to think about how you can enrich the history curriculum by making those very, very explicit curriculum connections. So it's interesting at a moment, because what we're seeing across Australian curriculum policy is a much less even implicit orientation to futures. And what we're actually seeing is this notion of an economic driver. You know, we need societies that are sustainable in terms of business and thinking and orientation. And that also makes some assumptions. So, you know, the kind of things that we're seeing, again, the adaptation to the local curriculum, the idea that we can change syllabus, but we're privileging the same enlightenment curriculum for particular knowledge forms that are most important and actually offer cultural capital to students to engage in their classroom. So, you know, the way that we're measuring and privileging and pitting and education is having a different purpose. Across some of the years of my research, I've mapped a range of the way that we see in curriculum policy an orientation towards the future. Now, these particular ones you can see have now, all for a variety of reasons, changed. But generally what they'll point to is how explicit, so how much we're actually developing skills, knowledge, concepts and all of those things, and how much we're just assuming they're going to be done and that people are able to make the connection. So I'd like to break those things open. So one of the ways that I've explored the research, and I've spent ridiculous amounts of time distracting myself from the real research and building these models, which for those in recording, I'm happy to share some of those so they can see them. But one of the things I've been most interested in is, as a teacher and in a school, how do the areas of futures, you know, how people think about time, schools as learning environments and curriculum all kind of come together? And then over a number of different classrooms and countries, I've started to map what happens when you take different aspects of those and mix them together. And what I've used is a vehicle of professional learning. So I'll often induct teachers into thinking about different ways of engaging in futures in classrooms, and then help them to adapt those principles to their local context, right? Still acknowledging curriculum policy, still making sure that we've got really rich and rigorous disciplinary learning, but just trying to turn them. And look, as I think about it, different things erupt. I think, you know, when you start to look at what happens between the spaces of futures and thinking about time, we've got incredible bias. We orient our students to history always. We privilege that what's been happening in the past years bar better or more important or gives them greater culture. And I'm not saying that we should ever ignore the past, because most of futures principles depend upon us connecting that really long extended present. And that's really important. So that's to give you a bit of background on how complicated. And then to make it more complicated, then I start to kind of map through diagrams and then turn them on their sides and do all of those kind of things, just to see the ways that interactions in classrooms can be broken up. And for each one of those, I can show you evidence of the type of examples. But tonight it's about actually trying to get you to a point where I can start to show you what happens in classrooms and the best ways that we can break it open. So let's do that. So Wendell Bell is somebody who's written over time, and it's this idea of future studies making a future accessible for different groups of students. And it's about, rather than being passively involved or, you know, living through a predetermined future, it's about taking a very active role and making critical decision making in order to really position somebody as being able to make a difference in their life. Caroline Smith often talks about the notion of hope in society and how that positions us as very, very passive. You know, we hope something's going to happen. And she talks about this idea of agency. And I see futures studies as a form of agency, particularly when you're beginning to integrate into really powerful curriculum. So David Hicks talks about images of the future. And one of the critiques that I've written of the futures field more broadly is that sometimes what happens when we're not futures and education is we tend to focus on one aspect of future studies. So whether it just be images of the future, and then how do we break those open in a number of ways to be able to really engage young children and older children in being able to examine some of those things that we might take for granted? How is it that we use different images of the future? How is it that we talk to young people about their images of the future? And I might come back to that. We're nearly through the really theoretical part, but I think it's really important to know why you make the claims that you're making and the possibilities. So time perspectives is an area that has really strongly influenced my work. A time perspective is the way that we're able to think about what modality we're in of time. So our, you know, at the moment, we would argue in a Western culture that we're in the present. What's happened before is our past. What will happen is our future. And that's what we talk about as time perspectives. When we're talking specifically about when we're thinking about the future, that is our futures time perspective, or FTP in psychology. The and that's the other thing we call that is our temporal orientation. So what we've actually attuned our attention to. The idea of temporal bias is something that really interested me as an educator. You know, how do we create a temporal balance and shift, you know, how it is that our temporal orientation is working? When babies are born, they're born as futures-oriented people. You know, they learn at a very, very quick, you know, period of time that if they scream, there's going to be a response. Something happens. So there's lots of stuff in there about anticipation. As we get older, probably somewhere around the age of 18 months, we start to become a little bit more familiar with the idea of, you know, anticipation. In the morning, when you wake up, often a mother will use a really good strategy of, you know, it's time to go to bed now. When you wake up in the morning, we're going to go to the playground. We're going to do those things. A little bit further along, probably about 9 months later, generally, you know, we can't kind of lock it in that closely. There's the reverse happens. Remember last year when you had a birthday? Remember when you did something? So we begin to introduce these time perspectives, you know, almost culturally. And then something happens when we begin to kind of get older, where we're actually starting to lock children much more in to remember that birthday, remember when we get those holidays. So we're actually training that temporal bias in lots of ways. And in Western culture, it's quite different to Eastern culture, because the way that we think about time is much more circular in an Eastern culture compared to in a Western culture. It's much more linear, past, present, future. We're very good at organising everything into. Around the age of four, you see children grappling with their ability to kind of manage time. You know, tomorrow I went to the supermarket. You know, yesterday I'm going to go to the playground. So often language is a really interesting way of examining temporal orientation. Then somewhere around 12, there are people who would argue, such as McInerney, that around the age of 12 we have the ability to be much more mindful of how we shift our temporal orientation. And that the other thing is that connected to a concept of the extended present, or the use of the family chain, which I'll come to in more detail, is this idea that we are connected to the generation before, the generation after. And for a 12-year-old, educationally, that's the area of time that they're able to manage at a bit. And then as we get older, you know, the idea is that it broadens. Originally, when I started my PhD, I had this theory that if we ask somebody what their favourite moment or the period of history they were most interested in, and then we said to them, what do you think is going to happen in the future? I had this idea that there'd be some kind of balance, you know. If you went out 100 years, you'd go out 100 the other way. My PhD supervisor said you would never even begin to think about something like that. And so I didn't. Maybe that's a project that might be upcoming. But I think this is really important, and one of the things that I have found in a lot of my research is, and I'm playing with the idea of temporal mobility, how do you kind of keep moving yourself around and shift that? You have to be dexterous in a classroom, because there's so many minds going and so many ideas, and particularly as a teacher, how do you do that? And it's something. So this idea of the rhetoric is something that I'm really interested in. You know, we talk about being Lighthouse School, we talk about being schools of the future, but when you ask teachers, so I've done a lot of work with teachers, and they'll generally say, but I've never really thought about that part of it, or thought about it, don't quite know what to do with it. So on that basis, you know, I've argued that it's not that teachers don't want to do explicit futures education. It's just not really part of the way that we develop teacher education, or we create the spaces for this really creative and critical work to occur. And it's that as societies, generally, it's much easier to colonise futures through policy or other things, to create a singular future that we're working to, because that also helps just to kind of manage the way that we've reproduced past futures. some of the work I've done in schools has actually began to interrogate some of these ideas with teachers, how schools prepare students for their futures. And these are the very typical. So this is from one school, but I would argue that it's pretty typical. And it lists things such as, you know, the overarching thing is the statement at the top. Lots of ways we prepare our students for the future. School is where you try things out before you actually have to have a future. You know, so this idea of rehearsed futures, I mean, that's an interesting kind of, you know, school as a place. I'm not sure if you've ever read any of the work of Jonah Nardia, who wrote a book called How to Lose Friends and Infuriate People in response to Dale Carnegie's. And one of the things he talks about is that primary schools are the place that we learn to kind of be with other people, and we learn to kind of operate around bells, and that secondary schools is where we learn to exercise different parts of our brains and focus them on different things. And then uni is the time, or whatever you do in terms of technical skills, or is the part where we really begin to exercise our brains in a specialist kind of way. And I think that's really interesting to think about that. And the way that teachers generally, so I've worked across both secondary and primary, are making the connections between different disciplines and what they offer a student in the world. But it still doesn't get to the notion of a changing world. And our world has always been changing. So it's not that we're standing at a particular moment of time where the world has only just begun to change, and the world is only going to change in a particular way or the same way. And so that's really important to kind of disrupt. The other thing that comes up really loudly is that futures education is really about preparing students to work. The first schools were actually set up on that principle. Bells told people how to turn their brain on to different activities, when to rest, all of those things, you know, when to sit down in a way, when to not. Our school systems have evolved significantly since those first schools, but most people assume that the notion of the future is connected to preparing for work and not the other aspects of life. So the things that they say are things like, you know, to work people need to be able to do, you know, think, write, spell, count, maths, turn up, dress and behave appropriately, you know, follow instructions. And what's interesting when you compare the two lists of what teachers say about the functions of school is that the left-hand side of the screen, which lists the connections between disciplines and futures, and the right-hand side of the screen, which talks more about the type of attributes you need for work, one is actually what we talk about as the formal curriculum of a school, and the other one is about the enacted or the informal or the unintended curriculum of a school often. And when we talk to employers and industry and lots of other stakeholders, they would argue that it's the right hand of the screen that is the most important with what creates a really healthy and productive society. So it's about the balance between a cognitive and an affective or a non-cognitive kind of curriculum that is most important. So the general principles that we use when we're talking in a classroom about thinking about futures is that the future cannot be predicted. So I love this idea of a crystal ball, you know, and actually being able to predict something absolutely. Often in my classroom, the launching place as a teacher that I would often use to begin was in a unit on probability, chance of data. What is the chance of something happening if I roll a dice, if I do those things? You know, then can I use the same principles to judge, you know, what's the weather's going to be like, you know? And that's a really interesting way for students to be able to get their heads around the type of, you know, language, the meta language of futures thinking that's really important. We talk about multiple futures in classrooms. So generally the way that we frame it is called the three Ps. We talk about possible futures, we talk about probable futures, and we talk about preferable futures. The Club of Rome talk about a fourth P, which is plausible futures or believable futures. And so this idea of possible futures is one that's accessible to all students. What do you think is possible here? And it may be that anything's possible, but the minute we then start to overlay more critical frames, they're able to determine, you know, what is more likely or not likely. The idea of probable futures is critical because it's about drawing upon other information that's happening around in order to make decisions of what's possible or what's not. And then preferable futures is that idea of what I would want to happen or what would be, you know, preferable for a group of us. You've got these other words underneath that I'm just going to let hang for a moment. because the other type of futures we talk about is the intersecting futures. So, you know, how do we talk about personal futures, local futures, and global futures? And there are a whole group of theorists out there that would talk about global futures and the tension between what goes on the most local and immediate and what's happening and, you know, whose rights are more important or what we need to think about. So these other red words underneath, used futures, recycled futures, pop futures, implicit futures, I don't take those into a classroom. But what I do is I help students and teachers particularly to use those type of words to be critical of things that they're taking for granted. So I'll show you some of those. The idea of used futures are the types of assumptions that I may have made about my own future. Those children who were waiting for their turn on the factory line. So they didn't engage in learning at seven because they already knew they had a job to go to. Unfortunately, a lot of those factories had closed down by the time that the schools had, you know, they'd finished school. The idea of recycled futures is, you know, it's interesting when you work with young children looking at the asylum seekers at the moment, and this idea that this is the first time in Australian history where we've even had, for example, boats arriving on the shores of Australia. And when you actually use a lot of the archive materials out of the National Library, you can actually see the images, and young children get this sense of even, for example, the Vietnamese boats and the refugees that were fleeing at that time. This idea that unless we learn from the really powerful lessons of our history, we'll continue to recycle the same futures. So this really important need to be really critical of what goes on. The idea of pop futures, I'm going to give you some really cool examples of that. You know, the things that we see, the Jetsons, Futurama, the images that often position us to assume a particular future. I mean, don't you all know we're going to have a technology chip kind of in our head because that's what the big technology companies, you know, tell us we're going to have. And it's really important not to assume a future. The idea of token futures that we just scratch the surface, that tacit futures are just kind of really light touch, that we're not going beyond any depth. So I'm going to show you a particular approach that I've developed in order to help students, help teachers think about how to organise futures thinking. Implicit, that we're not really mindful and we're not bringing it out into the open. And explicit is using really clear meta language and discourses, even from the younger stages of 4 or 5. We don't have to use really, really, you know, big words and highly critical, but I would hate to water it down. I want to be able to use critical terms, which is why most of my futures, in particular in primary classrooms, hangs on those 3 P's. You know, what's possible, what's probable, what's preferable. Are we talking about a local, a personal, or a global? I'll show you some examples. So here's an example of one of the types of tools that I use in a classroom. This is a 10-year-old. And this was her very first draft. This is called a Y diagram, and different people use it in different ways. But I'll just give you the story of Demi. So, you know, most children, so a lot of people will ask why a singular line at the top. Well, that's because the past has already occurred and we've got a story that we can tell. And most children will actually hook that to the developmental kind of moments in their life. Demi's was an interesting story, though, because she learnt to walk, she went to kindergarten, she went to school, she dislocated her elbow, big events in a young child's life. She went to a new school because her parents divorced. Her sister moved to Queensland. Her sister didn't move to Queensland. She waited at a truck stop in Broadmeadows somewhere, jumped on the truck and ran away to Queensland. I went to Queensland for a holiday. No, my sister moved back from Queensland because her parents went to get her and brought her home. She went to Queensland for a holiday. She came back from home. Freud would say that there was a lot to be kind of resolved around Queensland and that journey. But they are really significant moments that have mapped part of her past. The next point, which is where the birthification happens, on one future, so she's identifying 2 possible futures, all right? And often at the first level, I do this through forecasting. So the idea is I'll get a student to say, okay, so here's now. What happens at the next step? What happens at the next step? What happens at the next step? As we become more sophisticated in our use of some of these tools, what I'll get them to do is to forecast on one arm, step it out, and I actually teach them that physically, and then I'll get them to backcast on the other. So to backcast is to begin at the end and then work out what happens in between the final outcome and then. So here's Demi's story. Demi goes to high school. That's a really good thing in that particular area. A lot of the kids were pretty keen to get out of school as early as they could. She went to high school. She goes to university. She's a lawyer. She gets stalked by a guy she does a case against. She gets frozen. She's still frozen. She gets defrosted and she dies. So at face value, that really doesn't mean anything, but it actually tells you a lot about how Demi's view of the world is and some of the things that she's assuming, some of the things that she's learning from, you know, whatever it is she's interacting with. And so this idea that a lawyer gets stalked by a guy that they do a case with, you know, is the way that she's connecting up her world, her schema. And as a teacher, it's a really great opportunity to be able to talk. So, you know, in the classrooms that I've taught in, I'll often use this as a conference time to sit down with students and to explore these things. And I'll give you an example of a Divya. Demi's other future, she goes to high school, she goes to university, she becomes a comedian. I asked her why she becomes a comedian, you know, after going to uni, and she said, because my dad said that that's where funny people go. Her dad actually didn't mean comedians, you know, it was kind of more that universities, you know, were an odd place. But it was because that was a foreign land for her dad. So there's a whole lot of things that Demi didn't even understand as a 10-year-old about, you know, the orientations and the reasons. She gets taken to Mars by an alien. She meets a guy in Mars. She has a kid. She gets taken back to Earth. She gets burnt. She dies. She's reborn again. This idea of being reborn is something that, you know, the notion of pop futures, you know. There's also other things that are quite interesting about getting burned and being frozen. You know, the burning, any ideas? Is about re-entering the Earth's atmosphere. So she's got this really sophisticated idea that somewhere she knows that you can get out of the Earth's orbit, but you can't come back in. You know, she's got this idea that cryogenics, still frozen and defrosted, I quite like that. And if you actually have a look at a Futurama clip that comes not long after when Demi writes this, you can actually see that kind of timer go off. There's lots of take, and there's lots of stuff that she's showing she's interested in or she's aware of that we could actually really untangle in terms of her education. You know, cryogenics, how interesting. You know, what is it that you know? How is it that you know those things? Is that really? Is it possible? Is it probable? Walt Disney thought it was, you know, probable a number of years ago. Has it happened? You know? So, I mean, that gives you the idea of how a child will come to the tool. There are another example of the way that students use these kind of tools is that they map out the world's history and then generate where they think, you know, the possibilities for the world's future are. Other things that I've done with these wire diagrams is on the verification, I'll put a news article from a newspaper, and I will explore the history of what's happened in that event, and then I'll work out the possible futures that arise from that thing that's happening right now. So these tools are really powerful and really accessible to children. I use these for my own decision making in my life. All right, so here's what I'm doing now. How is it that I'm going to come? What happens if I do this? What happens if I do this? I think the notion of personal futures, I mean, this is my own personal future, but working with children, you know, it's really interesting to think about the journeys they've been on. For me, growing up in a, you know, a suburb that was probably lower socioeconomic, you know, my most fascinating moment was this woman around the corner who had a suitcase on wheels. Like, that was wild technology. And my project in grade three was to find out what I wanted to be when I grew up. Well, because she had the suitcase on wheels, I wanted that too. And I said to her, so it just shows about the allure of technology. And I said to her, so what do you do? And she said to me, I'm an air hostess. And I said, how do I become an air hostess? And she said, don't worry about it till you're 18. Then you ring TAA. Well, there's no TAA to ring. You ring TAA and then you become an air, you get wings. Now, I can't blame her for the things that didn't go right in my life between grade three and the rest of it. But I often wonder what would have happened if she said, well, you know what, you need to work really hard at school and you need to, you know, or whatever, you know, the things that we take for granted. So for me, my journey was that I didn't grow up to be an air hostess. When I left school, I had no idea what I wanted to do because school and I didn't really get along very well. I became a hairdresser. My dad had been a fitter and turner. So, Deborah, every good person needs a trade to fall back on. So that's exactly what I did. And I had a terrible car accident, had a brain injury. And through that process, Dad would have said it knocked sense into me, but through the process what happened was that I had to go through kind of a form of futures counselling, if you like, to see what I was going to do. And the first thing they said is, have you ever thought about going into education? I was like, you've got to be joking, you know? And that was the moment my whole life turned on in lots of respects. But I was able to bring all that other stuff. So from hairdressing, then to teaching, then once I turned on, you know, there was no kind of stopping. I'd always assumed that the boyfriend I had the accident with, you know, would kind of become the one that I bought the same house that my parents had, that I'd have the same number of kids. So there was lots of assumed and kind of reused futures going on. Unfortunately, my husband went to work one night and didn't come home. And I had a 10-week-old and a 17-month-old to bring up. That's changing futures. You know, you have to be really explicit and you make very, very clear choices about the ways in which you engage with the rest of your life. And the choices are to really go for constructive futures or to not. And one of the areas that I'd be really interested in doing research on in some point is I often wonder about addiction. You know, and whether addiction is our ability to move beyond a particular temporality. You know, whether something happens in a particular moment that's really difficult to kind of move beyond. Enough about me. So educational theory, Pat Thompson talks about this idea that in every classroom, kids are carrying stuff that you can't see, the virtual school bags. And we either ignore them or we open them up and we explicitly kind of begin to, you know. And there's another body of research that's really complementary that talks about the idea of funds of knowledge and that teaching is an ethical job. Every bit of curriculum that we design is ethical because we either choose to include something or we choose to omit it. And the choice that teachers have, and I think that governments have, which is why often I write quite critically about curriculum policy, is that we either choose to focus on what students bring and build on it, or we focus on the deficit, you know, and just assume that nobody has it and teach the same curriculum anyway. And for me, I guess that's the crisis that we face in having a singular curriculum that doesn't articulate a type of futures. So when we think about that notion of assume, teachers talk about the idea that they've never thought about the stuff. There's not time to think about this stuff. Isn't that interesting? We haven't got time to think about time. You know, and so because we haven't got time, we don't do it. Because often we're carrying the weight of the past. I'm going to show you an interesting tool that you probably know, because I'm taking for granted a whole lot of stuff about what you don't know. So excuse me and just tell me to move on if I'm telling you stuff you've already well and truly got. But this idea that we're not even connecting this often in our own families. You know, we'll do something particularly around when a child hits a point in their schooling. So what are you going to do when you grow up? Quick, now you need to work harder. You know, I want you to be your best. I want you to be a... But what are we being our best for beyond ourselves? What type of, you know, conversations can make it explicit? And it's just generally that as a culture, Western societies, you know, lose that futures time orientation. So a couple of more futures concepts and tools that I use. So the extended present, you know, from a cognitive psychology viewpoint, Piaget and a number of others have used this to be able to talk about the length of time that somebody is able to conceptualise the present moment rather than there's a present gone, present gone, present gone. And one of the really nice concepts that I use in a classroom is the notion of a 200-year extended present, particularly up to about a 12-year-old, that I am the centre of my extended present, that my parents are the living generation of my past. My grandparents came before them. And if I can help children to think about time in terms of being connected to others, it's very, very powerful. In the same way that, and you can imagine the response when I say this to a 6-year-old, you know, your children are going to be, you know, what do you mean? You know, I'm never going to have children. I'm going to live with my mum forever. You know, then your grandchildren, you know, are your living futures generation. And so that's how often in schools we help children to be able to conceptualise time and to be able to connect the types of what generally people would talk about as predictions or hypotheses or scenarios. And so it gives them a really nice framework to work from. My other favourite one from the classroom is The Foresight Principle. Richard Sawyer, I think this was one of the first books that he wrote in terms of futures. And it's not so much the book that I love, it's the concept of the mirror, you know, that when we learn to drive, you know, our driving instructors tell us mirrors, signals, brakes. And the whole idea of the mirror is that we are glancing always back at our history to learn the really powerful lessons. You know, why do we continue to send people to war when there's been so many things unresolved in our past? You know, why is it that we use fragile, you know, why is it we've developed fragile? I'll show you some stuff about that and children as well. And forecasting, backcasting, incasting is really powerful in a classroom. Forecasting, you know, physically stepping stuff out, backwards, you know, backcasting and filling in gaps. And then this idea of incasting, what's happening around us that can tell us whether something is more probable, what other things are in the wind. And children quite like that, what other things, you know, what else could come out of the blue that you're not expecting. That is, that's often where kids really get quite excited. So, Future Triangle, are you familiar with the triangle? This is a great tool for the classroom, wonderful tool. So I'm going to show you an example of how we apply the triangle. There are ways that we can examine any image of the future or anything that's happening in our news. So we talk about this idea of the pull of the future. There's something in the future that's pulling us towards a particular thing. The one I thought we could do as an example is, you know, the whole digital educational revolution. Everything's going to go to technology. We're all going to have chips. We're all going to do those things. The push of the present is generally we've got to get there. So I'm going to show you how this kind of works out. And this is a one that I've done with teachers. So all the ones I'm going to show you are examples that I've done with teachers for their professional development. And then the weight of the past. That's often what holds us back. Oh, we really shouldn't go there because... And so what we do is we articulate each one ways of looking at these issues. And then we come to a bit of a point about, you know, how preferable, how probable... there's a lot of other frames that really technical futurists use, and they're really interesting to read, but they're not as accessible for teachers and children in classrooms. So I keep using the same things and adapting them in different ways because it really builds very powerful discourse in a classroom. So the pull of the future would be a statement such as this that Peter Garrett made a number of years ago. It's imperative that Australian students have access to world-class computers technology if we remain competitive in increasingly global, right? Let's get there. We've really, you know, here it is. This is what it's all about. The push of the present is, for example, the teachers. So I'm going to use an example of what teachers say so you can get a sense of the push of the present. That, you know, the techno age was taking over the world. You can't get away from it. You're on 24 hours a day. Got to be amongst it. You know, this idea of whatever's going to happen is just going to happen. You've got to go with it because this is the way that the world's moving right now. So you're looking for evidence. You're looking for signs. And kids quite like doing this as mysteries, right? So they're looking for cues and clues in the world that kind of tell them that this is what's going on. The weight of the past. Anyone want to have a go at the weight of the past? What holds you back from going towards this whole kind of technology? Just think about being a school teacher. What might prevent you from kind of launching into the whole kind of digital space?
Your own skill.
Could be your own skill. Any other ideas of what might be in the way? There could be a whole lot of things.
Resources of the school.
Resources of the school are certainly something that are going to hold you back.
Your own attitude.
Your own attitude. So I was going to actually show you, because you've kind of hit on a couple of things, I'm going to show you a conversation between a group of teachers. So when I asked the question at a PD, you know, do you think kids are still going to use pens and pencils in the future? And the teacher said, how practical, they're children, you know. It's a crazy kind of a question. I don't think they will. If you have a look at technologies and what children can do, at home and on school, they prefer to work on computers. Even as teachers, we don't write much as my teachers did. No, they won't use pens and pencils as they are now, just like we didn't use inks, quills, stones and sticks. You know, there's a whole lot of stuff that's kind of... You can't say... This teacher was so distraught. You can't say that! Of course they'll use pens and pencils for some things, just as we do now, you know. And then you'll hear the things we need for our human development to teach them that letter formation. We need, you know, that's part of our, you know, whole cross meridium of our brain to be able to do that. So how true is it? So this gives us a really interesting critical lens to be able to make decisions and to critically evaluate the types of things that go on. And for children and teachers, so I'm not going to pretend that teachers don't need to do this as well, because there's a great deal of value. But children love doing this stuff. Oh, no, you're holding us all back. Why are you holding us back? You know, and so how do we... It's a really... Look, even if you weren't doing futures, it's a really useful tool to examine the different kind of dynamics of decision-making. One of my favourites is a temporal scanner. And you can make these for almost anything. And for children generally, particularly young children, we use looking back, looking around. So looking back is towards the past, very Kantian. Looking around as the present, looking forward as the future. And I'll give you an example of the type of thing. So one of my favourite one is values. And this is a 10-year-old's temporal scanner. So looking back, values, everyone thought the same way and used the same manners because everyone was the same and taught the same way to act. Looking around now, most people think the same, but not everybody understands the same rules or the right way to act if it's a different place from where you're born. Like, you can act some ways in Dandenong, but you can't act that way in the city. This school is actually in Dandenong, right? So, you know, it's very, very much connected to them. In the future, people are just going to live with others who believe the same stuff and act the same way. So we're not even going to try and integrate or be able to kind of interact with it. Simple. Just put everyone where they belong, and this is really powerful. So we wouldn't have done that. We didn't do this particular scanner just as a random act. This was within a really big kind of unit on culture and global perspectives. And we started to look at things. You know, when you start to think about technology, you know, we use the wheel as a technology. You know, looking back, before the wheel was invented, people used to walk places and they used to ride animals. Looking around, people get around now in cars, motorbikes and on trains and buses. People use trains and buses and rockets and space backpacks to get around. Simple. Children are much more oriented. Jane Page has written a whole range of stuff. Children are much more oriented and much more able. This kind of stuff builds our temporal mobility. I've worked with groups of teachers where I've used the same thing to explore different things that are going in their school. So what's happening now? What was it like 5 years ago? What do you think it's going to be like 5 years ago on exactly the same thing? Right? It just really helps you to get your head around, literally, a number of different issues. So that left-hand side for temporal scanning, you can put in anything you want there. And it's just about kind of exploring that temporality. Another one I'm not sure if you're familiar with, that Oliver Freeman, Melanie Williams, and that used in open book scenarios, a big educational project a number of years ago funded by Teaching Australia, which is no longer with us. And they never intended it to be used this way, but I've just adapted it for a completely different use for classrooms. So it's what they built it was as a scenario building, but I think it's really good to help students understand, you know, how to access an image or of the future, or how to be able to create or make sense of things. So Inspect goes like this. So it begins with the I in the middle, I on the future, N, what is the nature involved in this scenario? S, you know, how do people socially interact in this scenario or this image? What is the political framework here? And it's a very, very straightforward way for students to analyse what they're seeing in front of them or to make decisions. So an example that I've used with teachers, particularly in universities and that, so all activities in higher education will be, there's a statement. It's the image of the future, the eye on the future, the pull of the future. You know, so you can use the same tools to do this, you know, a variety of things or come at it from different directions. All activities in higher education will be in virtual. There's the digital again. Degrees will be awarded on a central authority based on badging. Right, that's the hot thing in universities at the moment. So then you begin to work around what is the natural implications of this. The natural world is valued. So what does this type of approach to higher education look like in our world? What happens to the kind of value of nature or the place of nature? And you start to build your own kind of sense of what's possible. You know, how do people... Look, How probable are these? Yes, no, who knows? But at least they're giving something for us to kind of launch from. We're developing these really complex ideas of constructs of images of the future. And in the same way, when we see a video clip or we see other type of popular futures, we can actually deconstruct them in exactly the same way. What are we seeing here in terms of, nature? What are we seeing in terms of social? What are we seeing in terms of culture? What is it that we're seeing in terms of technology? To play the same clip for a group of students and get them to look, or to get different groups to really examine, you know, this is critical literacy at its finest. And using very, very clear scaffolds to be able to do it. And you're actually kind of creating a story, using a narrative methodology almost to be able to construct and deconstruct. You can do your pull of the future, that in the middle could be any statement you want. You know, all sheep are going to be cloned. You know, James Heard, you know, he's going to be coaching at another club in that. You know, whatever it is that you want to have as your image of the future, you can put in the middle. James Head was only on my mind because on the office doors here, there are footballers' names as you walk along that. So this idea of images of the future is really powerful. One of the things I'll often talk to teachers about is how much they take for granted in terms of images of the future. So this idea, for example, of the Jetsons, you know, written in 1950s, based on a whole lot of images of the future. You know, and I'll say, you know, we need to critique these popular futures. We need to think about this idea of 3Ps. And then the teacher says, but does this mean we're not going to be able to walk into a wardrobe? You know, and she's been waiting for that moment. You know, there's been other things that, for example, I would love Rosie the robot to kind of wander around my house and, you know, clean it up. But you know how much we take for granted, and it's up to we begin to have these conversations that we begin to open them up. You know, I've just talked to you about the pens and pencils. But Eleanor Mazzini talks about the future is the only temporal area that we can really take an active part in. And so to remain passive is to pay a massive disservice to the students that we're educating. Alvin Toffler talked about exactly that. You know, that we need to be really critical in the way that we engage in this stuff. I'm really aware that I've already been talking for a long time. Do you mind if I keep going, or do you want to...
Okay.
Yeah? Because what I'd like to do is show you some of the ways that we go about planning and how we integrate some of these ideas in. And, you know, Charles, if you like, I can give you some kind of slides and images for you to use.
Thank you.
So there are many ways to teach futures. Somebody who's had a really big influence on how I view my role as an educator is David Hicks in the UK. I've spent a lot of time with him. And one of the things that I really like about using some of his work, even though he's now doing much more, you know, his passion project about sustainability and environment, is the way that he uses really practical examples to help students visualise some of the things he's talking about. And in one of his first books, which is called Educating for the Future, it was published by the World Wildlife Fund, he actually has a whole range of scenarios that are perfect to begin talking about the possible futures in the classroom and what would be preferable. You know, what happens if we continue to throw our rubbish everywhere? What happens if we, create a society where everything's perfect? What happens, you know, he uses some really good constructs to do that. So the basis of all good futures curriculum in a classroom, whether it's preps, whether it's uni students, is based for me on four basic moves. The idea of multiple futures. Multiple futures, the idea that personal, local, global, professional, social knowledge, you know, the complex kind of way that we come to thinking about futures. That when I think about the concepts, that some things continue, some things don't. Another word for discontinuity in a classroom is change. And it's really interesting when you set the challenge for kids to recognise something that hasn't changed over time. You know, there are very few things that haven't changed over time. You know, that haven't changed over time. The idea of that extended present is really powerful for kids to keep moving behind between the time of their grandparents. And it also shows tremendous respect and value for all of the people that have come before them and all the people that will come after them. The idea of the foresight principle, looking back, you know, looking around before we make decisions, is really powerful. And those 3 Ps, The type of tools, you know, forecasting, backcasting, incasting, causal layered analysis. Sahail Iyatala is somebody who's written a lot in this area and probably has developed the tool most sophisticatedly. And even at the most basic levels, critical literacy helps us to help young children to be able to explore what the privileged message or the greatest value or the scenarios that we're working with. And the skill of really great teachers is to be able to move through that in really powerful ways. And then using different cycles, the Y diagrams, T cycles, and then applying it. So I'm going to show you, now this is kind of my version of the ideal way to go about teaching futures in a classroom, but there's lots of other kind of, there's actually not a lot of examples of it because a lot of people have never really done it. And so this is my version of it based on, you know, what really has worked for me over time. I think that it's really powerful to begin with an image of the future and to be able to think about how I'm located in it. So whether it's my image of the future for me, whether it's my image of the future for the world, whether it's my image of my local area. It's a really powerful place. Then to start exploring the images of the futures of others. There is popular culture I was going to use, but for example, there's other things we can do. So in the 70s, there was a cyclone in Darwin. What was the future of that cyclone? So using really powerful moments in history, in particular locations, to think about what happened after that. So if another cyclone came, what would happen after that? What are the things that we've learnt from that particular scenario? And we generally don't do it just as a futures unit. What we'll generally do is infuse it within a much more powerful conceptual curriculum. You know, the idea that when we see things in the news, that was Dolly the sheep. What is that image of the future? What does it mean if everybody's kind of just cloned? What are the implications of that? Then for me, I like to go into what I call the understanding phase. So the first one's thinking about futures. The next one is starting to think about what type of possible futures are beyond my own scope. And then probable futures. So I'm developing the discourse. I'm using all of this stuff. And I'm trying to make the connections on the complexity. So this is going to show you how crazy it gets. So possible futures around the images. Is an image I see possible? You know, is it probable? Is it preferable? What about what is possible in my personal futures? What is possible in my local? You see, you get it, right? It just becomes more and more complex as we begin to layer these really simple ideas and begin to explore them. And then often what I'm doing is I'm offering other provocative images of the future for students to really grapple with. And obviously the older they are, will have a lot to do with the type of temperament of the things that I'm doing. From the understanding phase of thinking about futures, then I'm starting to work with the images of the future. So this is my own kind of version of the approach. So how do we know if something's possible? These are things that we actually have to explicitly teach in our classroom. So how do we know if something's more possible, probable? So then I would start to use some of my tools. You know, I would use my temporal scanners. I would think about the extended present. I would connect a particular thing that's happened within it. What happened before it? What's going to happen after it? Forecasting, backcasting. I would be starting to do things like I might build scenarios. I might dismantle scenarios. This all makes it sound very dry, but as an application, which I'll show you, it actually becomes an incredibly creative process in a classroom. And the fact that nobody's in control of what's going to kind of come, the teacher is providing the scaffold the whole way through. So one of the things in my research that's been most interesting is that the greatest struggle that most teachers have, they love it, but the greatest struggle is they're no longer in control. That's a really big thing in a classroom. But what you generally find is the engagement of students is so deep and rich that taking them away from what they're trying to engage in is often the biggest challenge that you experience. You know, so starting to use those tools, starting to play with some of those things, and then for me, then the next thing is about how deep do we go? How do we make choices? We can do a whole unit on futures based on how we behave in a school, what our civic responsibility is in the world. You know, we can... So the way that I generally plan is, I think about it as a critical knowing phase. So how do I plan my curriculum in a school? There are some occasions where I'll do a futures unit which is discrete. Often if I'm just introducing or I'm working with a group of teachers who have never ever really explored the futures field, I'll try and help them to build a pretty discrete small introduction to futures. Could be in their maths unit, chance and data, probability. Some of them might just be a futures of my playground. You know, it might be a futures of something. Sometimes futures is a really great extension work, a type of extension for other curriculum that's being done. Project-based learning, negotiated inquiry is my favourite way to use futures, because generally you'll start with a big idea and then you'll be managing lots of different projects as you go. Or it's the glue for interdisciplinary planning. So to give you an example of what that looks like, this one is a straight-out futures unit, a planner. It was called Doom, Gloom or Boom. Is ours a fascinating or frightening future? And in this one, there were particular things that the teachers were going to look at. If the future was about, what is the future? Is it about prediction, foresight? What do superhumans, you know, tiny machines, you know, this was a grade 6, so for 12-year-olds, this particular, so this is an example of a discrete. They had a really full scope and sequence that kind of outlined the future skills that they were developing in their curriculum. And over time, they got to this idea where they started to engage in students' own projects as a result of the explicit futures that they were doing in their classroom. But you can see this idea of the three Ps and all of those type of things coming. The second part of that was, you know, just, you know, we started to use Diamond Ranking. I'm not sure if you've seen those. Kind of, they're really fun tools as well in a classroom. Consequence wheels, lots of other things. So lots of visual organisers around the room, lots of really creative ways for students to explore different things that they were doing. Another example, which is like the glue or a really kind of explicit dimension, is when we build things. So this unit was one, Fun Through Time and Place, was exploring how children have had fun throughout time. So how did they used to have fun? How do they have fun now? How will they have fun? So it became a design type of unit. This was great fun. There's another one which is, for example, history never repeats, or does it? The idea of used futures. So let's explore some different times in history. Let's have a look at some different periods. Can you find, you know, a parallel in a different place or time? You know, what did we learn the first time it happened? What can we learn from the second? Is there anything that we didn't learn that we should have? And children love doing that. So it's the idea of history and histories, and starting to learn the lessons from history. So these are all based on inquiry approaches, where we're really scaffolding learning and then we're setting students off at different points to do different investigations. And then the third one is the money of music. For example, you know, what type of music has been popular through different time and different places? You know, if you're going to be designing a pop concert, you know, for 20 years, what is the artist going to be like? What type of music are they going to play? Where will they be touring in the world compared to where they might have been touring, you know, at the time of Elvis? So, you know, most of the children love doing those kind of classical moments. And so how does music change through time? So it doesn't have to be a really big, here's futures. It's actually about how you infuse it explicitly. And so it becomes extension of thinking about how we learn about our world. And then the other one is a more problem-based approach. And so this one is actually for an older group of students, a Year 8 group of students. No, this one could have been a Year 9 group of students. And what we did was we actually used multiple intelligences in order to explore a particular thing. And in this one, the teachers did all the planning. They got a whole lot of resources together first. They created packages and they ran workshops around the room at various times for students to engage in the workshops they needed in order to be able to resolve the tasks. And students had to complete over a term four different projects. So they would take four different project packs. And so this one was on future prediction. Some of them might have been on robotics. Some of them might have been on health futures. Some of them may have been on a range. And then the students had to choose three ways to respond to whatever the problem was. So it's kind of a challenge-based learning. And the older students really loved this. And then how do you represent that information in a range of ways? And then the type of projects, for example, when you use a project-based learning one, generally what you'll do is you'll induct students in one big idea, so whether it's futures, and then you'll find out the areas that the bulk of the students are interested in. This is one that was run at Warana Park in North Dandenong. There were 120 students in grade 6 all across one big learning space. We inducted them all into really powerful futures thinking, and then we asked them to enrol. So that we listened to what they were interested in. The teachers, five teachers, got up and pitched an idea. I'm going to run a project on whatever. If you're interested in this, another teacher got up. So the five projects that started were like techno futures. So in that one, students did things like, you know, in the past, you know, people used to die because their food wasn't preserved. The fridge was invented. This is what it's like now. And then they went through a design of what the future fridge might have been, phones, it might have been whatever. And a lot of those students then wrote to companies who were designing things and said, here's my design, what do you think about it? And in one of the schools that I've done this in, a school actually ended up with a new fridge, you know, from because a student got so into the design kind of bit that they wanted to give LG just constant feedback. You know, and then LG wrote back to them and said, actually, there's a problem with your fridge. You know, we can't have that kind of arm, you know, in the fridge or whatever. And kids want to design fridges where, you know, they were so clever that you walked up to them and, you know, if they heard your voice and you said, I want a cucumber, they knew it was your mum's birthday and a cake kind of appeared. You know, like, there were really sophisticated types of designs that they were thinking about. Global Futures was exploring how different cultures, and in this particular school, there was something like 52 ethnicities in the school. So a lot of kids were really interested in the countries that they'd left, what was happening in them now, particularly if they'd left as refugees, what was happening in that, and what was the possibility for the future of that country, and how the different parts of culture and traditions would evolve. This one was looking at news, and the types of news items were on and what those news articles would look like in 20 years. So there's a little film I'll play to kind of end. This one was about social futures. What hero am I going to be in the future? So it was a very personal futures, and the students explored what they were most interested in and the type of contribution that they could make to the world. And it was a really soulful, you know, Martha Rogers. I'll flick back to this one. Martha Rogers does this beautiful work about the idea that really great, powerful education, you know, engages much more than just the head. It does this kind of heart awakening and this soulful kind of work and this idea of a collective purpose, which the social futures did something quite remarkable for a group of kids who found it really difficult to go beyond their own space, but it was really powerful learning. And then Fantastic Futures was like an urban planning, an urban design unit, where they were beginning to redesign their local communities or think about what the changing demographic of a community meant for how things needed to be designed. And they actually talked to their local council. Carmen Stewart did a fairly big project a number of years ago, in around 97, I think, called Making Places. And they re-engaged a lot of disengaged youth through rebuilding their local communities. There are still some of those left. So that was a really powerful one. I guess they're the kind of things. I might just show you the news in 2030. And then we'll end on that note. Let me just hope it works. Oops. Maybe it's not going to. No, it doesn't look like it's. It was there. Oh, so maybe you're not going to see the news.
Sorry,
You've lost the image, and you need to see the image. And I wonder if I can place it. Oh, we've lost it. So sorry, you can't. I wonder if I've got it somewhere else. I won't try, but maybe I can give you that as a link, and you can play the news to everyone for 2030, and you'll see all the square chickens and the Monsanto's, you know, and all the new natural disasters that are going to happen because we're not kind to the world. I hope that's been a useful insight to you in terms of some of the work that I've done and some of the work that really cool and innovative schools are doing, both around Australia and Taiwan.
Hey.